had sneakily taken an adjoining room and surprised him by pounding on his door while announcing, "Servitore, housekeeping." Nate was secretly pleased. He was contemplating a dreary evening alone in his threadbare room watching the Berlin Euro Pop Contest on television. Agnes had other ideas. Whatever servo motor was ticking inside her, the chaste 3-day return cruise apparently had spun it up to redline levels. They made love everywhere but the bed, on the floor, in an armchair, in the bathtub with a sputtering hydrojet, and standing up on the tiny balcony ghost-lit by the neon hotel sign on the roof. Her heady perfume, she told him it was Chanel Cristal Auvert, mingled with the whiff of bunker sea fuel oil from the harbor around the headland. She had whispered, "Cruje miete de la siebe," "I feel mint for you," in colloquial Polish, meaning she had feelings for him. Mint wasn't the only thing she felt. Hours later, hands shaking, Nate poured Agnes some bottled water, but she was asleep on the bed, on her back, mouth open in a 6-orgasm syncope, hair fanned out on the pillow, her witch's streak partly visible. Nate floated a blanket over her and sat on the armchair across the room, looking at her, breathing. Sleeping with Agnes the first time had been a midnight impulse fueled by pre-op nerves. Tonight it was a celebration, relief at getting out of Russia in one piece, maybe a bittersweet farewell. Nate rubbed his face and groaned. Maybe he wanted to put impediments between him and Dominika so he wouldn't, could not, stumble with her again. He resolved to properly act as backup to Gable during meetings in the safe house. He would arrive late and leave early, making sure Gable was always in the room. He would let Gable explain to Diva why Nate was acting like a skittish puppy, let him deal with the inevitable outburst. Only one problem. Nate loved Dominika. As if Agnes could hear his thoughts, she mumbled fitfully in her sleep and turned over. "She feels mint for me," thought Nate miserably. The next day they were waiting for their separate flights at the airport. In a white blouse, pink skirt, and sandals, Agnes looked cool and collected. "Do you think I am too old for you?" she asked Nate, who looked up in alarm. "After last night, I'll let you know once my chiropractor hammers my spine back into alignment," said Nate. "I am being serious," said Agnes. "No, I don't think you're too old for me," he said. "But Agnes, there must be somebody in your life." "I think there is somebody in your life," she said, ignoring his question. "What makes you say that?" said Nate. Scary good radar, he thought. "Zerkalo dushi," said Agnes in Russian, searching his eyes. "Mirror of the soul," thought Nate. "Christ." "Things are complicated," said Nate, who had no intention of discussing his seriously contorted personal situation. "You live in London, isn't it?" Agnes said. "And you live in California?" "Not so far, I think," she said, not looking at him. Nate didn't answer. "Would a visit to London sometime be a bad idea?" Agnes said, then kissed him goodbye. The station's outside line rang with an exultant Hanefi on the other end. "Nate Bey, come quickly! There is a police car waiting for you downstairs." He was shouting over the sound of gunfire, a lot of it, including automatic weapons. "Hanefi, where are you?" yelled Nate. "Are you all right?" "Goddamn hell shit, bitch," said Hanefi, who was still learning to swear properly in English. "Chabuk Olmak, come at once." The drive in the dented police car, blue lights flashing and hee-haw siren wailing, driven by a jug-eared 20-year-old police corporal who pounded the steering wheel when traffic did not part, was transcendental. Gable's phrase, "scared as a sinner in a cyclone," came to mind. Metal ammunition boxes strewn on the rear seat slid back and forth on the curbs. They weaved through traffic across the Galata Bridge and rocketed down the south side of the Golden Horn past the darkened Greek Orthodox Patriarchate under the O-1 and into the dingy Eup district. The corporal took a steep road up the hill, tires squealing and fenders scraping along the stone guardrail. At one of the switchback curves, the entire sprawl of Istanbul was visible, its city lights bisected by the black slash of the Bosphorus, the end of Europe and the start of Asia. Dominica would be down there and they'd be together in 2 days. The police car locked its brakes and slid to a stop. More police cars were up ahead, stacked behind a big-wheeled Cobra armored car in blue and white TNP colors. The driver shoved 2 ammo cases into Nate's hands, took 2 himself, jerked his head, and started running uphill. It was a steep, narrow street with houses on either side, the window panes reflecting the 2-score flashing blue lights. The echoing cracks of incessant firing became louder. Clustered at the corner of a wall ahead were a group of TNP officers, some in uniform, others in jeans and leather jackets, peeking around the corner of the wall. Hanefi saw Nate and ran to greet him. "You bring ammunition?" he said, clapping Nate on the back. The wall across the street was suddenly riddled by bullets that chipped cement and filled the air with dust. Hanefi pulled Nate closer into the lee of the wall. "Hanefi, what's going on?"
4 people PKK in top apartment,"
said Hanefi, loading a magazine for his MP5. Other officers were digging into the ammunition like kids around a bowl of candy. Nate looked past them. The street was covered in spent casings, thousands of them brass winking in the flashing lights.
"How long have you been shooting?"
"Many hours. We ran out of ammunition."
He held his weapon out to Nate.
"Here, you try."
Nate shook his head. Hanefi barked something in Turkish to another officer who held out his weapon, a heavier assault rifle.
"Try this one."
Nate held up his hands in polite refusal. A bullhorn blared and the shooting slowed, then stopped. Hanefi pulled Nate by the sleeve to peer around the corner. The small apartment building was bathed in spotlights. The top floor apartment was marked by thousands of bullet holes, the windows were ragged gaps in the walls, and the concrete balcony railing was chipped and broken. It was a miracle that anyone could survive up there. "And this is going on all over Istanbul," thought Nate. Hanefi nudged Nate and pointed with his chin. 2 shadows, police commandos, were sliding slowly headfirst down the roof tiles. At the edge, they would reach over the gutter and throw fragmentation grenades down into the PKK apartment. Before they were in place, a young woman in a red parka ran onto the balcony with an RPG over her shoulder. Hanefi shouted and tried pulling Nate back. The woman aimed at them and fired the missile, but the backblast from the launching charge rebounded in the small space and blew the woman off the balcony. She cartwheeled 4 stories into a pile of rubble, followed by the missile that arced harmlessly to the ground. Hanefi looked at Nate in amazement.
"Bad luck," said Nate.
The grenades cracked and a thin plume of gray smoke came out of one of the windows. Another boom was followed by a flurry of shots, then silence, then the shrill blast of a whistle.
"All over. Let us go up," said Hanefi.
The interior of the little apartment was an eye-stinging charnel house, with a bullet hole in every square inch of the room. Wallpaper hung curled off the walls, a few pieces of furniture had been reduced to kindling, and a prayer rug smoldered in the corner. Bits of upholstery stuffing floated in the air. 2 men lay on the floor on their backs, bloody shirts pulled up to their chins. In the back bedroom, a young woman lay between the pulverized wall and a shredded box mattress, her fists clenched and mouth puckered, eyes half open. Black hair showed beneath a headscarf. Hanefi looked with interest at Nate's face, which had gone somewhat pale. He would not make fun of his new American friend. He patted Nate's shoulder.
"It's our job," he said, holding up 4 fingers. "Dirt. 4 terrorists captured dead," he said, using the TNP vernacular.
Shlikov's covert action had been ruined. 24 PKK cells had been wrapped up. The morgues were already full. The Russian munitions had been recovered, and the publicity would be devastating when the weapons would be put on display for the TV cameras. "Now let's take Shlikov for a ride," thought Nate. "And then it's up to Dominica." About the time Major Shlikov arrived in town to supervise his covert action arms shipments, the CIA base in Istanbul had begun transmitting covert agent electronic burst messages into the Russian consulate. Every day for a week, base officers, stiff wires running beneath their jackets and warm battery packs and spandex holsters under their skirts, walked among the shopping crowds on İstiklal Caddesi and passed the consulate gate topped with the double-headed eagle of the Russian Federation. They fired 3-second, 5-watt burst transmissions into the building. The energy bounced invisibly up the ornate marble staircases, ricocheted through the hallways, and rose like clear smoke up to the attic receivers. The consulate was awash in low-powered signals. They were encrypted gibberish, but the signals themselves were detectable and dutifully recorded by Russian SIGINT, signals intelligence officers, who endlessly monitored frequencies across the spectrum. A report was sent to FAORF, the Moscow SIGINT headquarters, immediately. The mysterious daily transmissions continued on a regular basis. A week later, when phone intercepts flagged that Shlikov was traveling from Istanbul to Ankara to confer with a senior resident, the burst transmissions in Istanbul ceased and commenced in Ankara. CIA station officers twice a day drove past the Russian embassy on China Kadesi, pushed the recessed buttons, and volleyed the encrypted energy over the embassy fence, through the granite walls, into the elegant Baroque sitting rooms and out the back of the building, to the withered formal gardens behind the embassy. This had not happened before. The astonished Russian SIGINT officers in Ankara also reported their readings to FAORF. These reports in turn were sent to the FSB. As a potential counterintelligence matter, neither Shlikov in GRU nor SVR headquarters was privy to the SIGINT reports, nor were they aware that a secret FSB file had been opened on unidentified encrypted electronic messaging activity in Istanbul. Signals of this sort were sophisticated and clandestine, and clearly suggested that someone in the Russian diplomatic contingent in Turkey was the recipient. The genetic, reflexive Kremlin assumption that there was a traitor in their midst, a cultural paranoia first introduced by the Tsars, nurtured by the Bolsheviks, refined by the Soviets, and perfected by Putin, smoldered in Moscow. Shlikov returned to Istanbul, and the transmission ceased in Ankara and again followed him. And when he traveled to Moscow for consultations regarding his covert action operation, the transmission stopped altogether, only to start up again on his return to Turkey, when he touched down at Istanbul's Atatürk Airport. The SIGINT log of these encrypted signals grew and the FSB counterintelligence file got fatter. It was not long until signals analysis matched the transmissions with Shlikov's movements. This delighted Gorelikov, whose refined, gracious exterior concealed an inexhaustible capacity for subterfuge and plotting. When Dominika had quietly brought home news of the murder of her North Korean asset, Gorelikov had listened implacably to Shlikov's dismissive explanation that the North Koreans almost certainly had detected Ri's treachery through some tradecraft era of Igorova's and had eliminated the scientist themselves. And as for the missing sparrow, either the North Koreans had dealt with her or she had run off with a ski instructor from the Tyrol. Gorelikov later listened to the recording of Blokin's voice in the cottage and had incongruously smiled. Additional evidence to hang this GRU apostate, but never a thought for Ioana, Dominika bitterly noted. Gorelikov took Dominika aside and for a day briefed her on the developments in Istanbul. Shlikov's operation had imploded, the munitions had been captured, the Turks were apoplectic, and Russia would be embarrassed on the international stage. The president no longer numbered Valery Shlikov as one of his favorites. They began choreographing a discreet counterintelligence investigation. SVR would have the lead role in the foreign field, meticulously led by a dutiful Colonel Igorova. "It's a shame you have to fly all the way to Istanbul. The findings of the investigation are already drafted," said Gorelikov. "Shlikov is responsible for the Obvol disaster, for which he must answer. But it is now more serious. He is suspected of espionage. But there it is, appearances matter, and you must play the part." But then came the sly question Benford had warned her about. "What do you think is going on in Istanbul with these transmissions? Did the Americans suspect something? Why did they focus on Shlikov?" "In Turkey, it could be any of a dozen things. That's why this covert action was ill-advised," said Dominika, matter-of-factly. "The Turks certainly have informers inside PKK. Perhaps a tradecraft problem with the delivery of weapons. U.S. SIGINT might be listening to chatter." Gorelikov polished his wire-framed glasses. "Or
We could have a mole in the Kremlin, he said softly.
Dominica willed her scalp not to creep.
Always a possibility, but unlikely, she said. Everyone in the council approved the plan.
Except for you, Bortnikov, and me, said Gorelikov. I can hardly credit the chief of FSB working for the opposition, and I know I am not a mole.
Which leaves me, said Gorelikov, amused.
A dangerous counter-revolutionary of the criminal Trotsky gang. Line KR will have to keep an eye on you, said Dominica, and the moment passed.
Is this a ghastly game to tell me he thinks I'm a spy? Take care.
Gorelikov was a serpent, tongue flicking, constantly testing the air. That night she wrote up the details and dead-dropped them to Ricky Walters to pass to Benford. She would have to be very careful. In Istanbul, CIA officers, in addition to sending burst transmissions, had begun marking signals, chalk marks on stone walls, tape on light poles, thumbtacks and trees, along Shlikov's walking route between his temporary Istanbul apartment and the Russian consulate. Because Shlikov wasn't looking for them, he didn't notice them. Very discreet surveillance of the major, done from the front and in phases, soon determined which cafes and restaurants he favored for solitary lunches and dinners. One of these was in Chichek Pasaji, a covered street arcade with a 19th-century Beaux-Arts latticework and glass roof. Whenever Shlikov ate there, he habitually ordered kadınbudu köfte, ladies' thighs köfte, plump lamb and beef meat fingers, fried crispy on the outside and succulent on the inside. One of half a dozen CIA officers sat close by, always facing him, always with a folded newspaper or a book or an eyeglass case on the table in plain sight. No contact was ever attempted. A steady stream of local commercial brochures, advertisements, and flyers were mailed to Shlikov's address announcing Bosphorus tours, condos for sale in Esentep, bus excursions to Bulgaria. The junk mail was collected and delivered by his toothless concierge. Shlikov thought nothing of the brochures and threw most of them away, but one or two of them were tossed in desk drawers and forgotten. They all had been lightly sprayed with household insecticide, a chemical component of which is phenothalein, a telltale of secret writing developer. There were no messages on this junk mail, all of it stiff and glossy with the dried aerosol patina. Nathaniel Nash sat in a nondescript Fiat Scudo van parked on a narrow side street in Istanbul with three technical officers from Langley. It was dusk and the final call to prayer had finished minutes ago. The steep Beylul neighborhood of grimy apartment buildings and first-floor shops was quiet and dark. There were intermittent rainstorms scudding across the city, and the alleyways, stairways, and gutters were periodically awash in a brown chyme, the composition unchanged since the Byzantine Empire. A cat sat under the eaves of a ground-floor apartment window shaking its paw. The van was parked three doors down from a brick-and-stone apartment building with a fabric canopy over double-glass doors in front. They were waiting for the crone, who was the concierge in the building, to leave her little desk in the entrance foyer and walk down to her basement apartment to start dinner for her husband. Instead, she stuck her head out of the door and poked the underside of the bulging canopy with a mop handle to empty it of accumulated rainwater. Nate and the three entry techs were waiting to break into the personal apartment of Valery Shlikov. The van was filled with the collective fragrances of the tool satchels each of them held in their laps, the bitter stench of electric motor oil, the pungency of wood putty and quick-dry paint, the gritty whiff of graphite powder, the sweetness of talcum. The techs, veterans all, sat silently looking straight ahead. Three good old boys, two from the deep south, who didn't use aftershave because it could linger on doorknobs and drawer pulls, and who didn't smoke because they sometimes had to lie on their stomachs in an attic for 72 hours straight. The books had them down as surreptitious entry techs, but it was less formal than that. These men had jimmied, shimmied, and picked their way into embassies, boudoirs, code rooms, and missile bunkers around the world. They called themselves rum-dubbers, or steel bolt hackers, Their Harley-Davidson and Jack Daniels belt buckles had squeezed past lathes and joists, under electrified wire, around cable runs, over roof slates covered in snow. Older now, in their 50s and 60s, they traveled less. A new breed, cuticle chewers with laptops, was needed to get past infrared cameras and biometric electronic locks. And the golden age of surreptitious entry had passed. No modern ops manager in the intelligence community today wanted to authorize a delicate physical entry operation with career-ending risk written all over it. But there were exceptions. In Shlikov's case, the object of this clam bake was not to emplace microphones or cameras, nor was it to open safes and quick copy classified materials with a rollover camera. Rather, the object of this surreptitious entry was to leave things behind. Kadın budu köfte, ladies' thighs meatballs. Divide ground lamb and beef into thirds. Sauté two-thirds of the ground lamb and beef with chopped onion until meat is cooked and onions are soft. Mix with remaining one-third raw meat, egg, parsley, salt, and pepper. Knead mixture to incorporate and refrigerate until firm. Form thick finger-size köfte, roll in flour, dip in egg wash, and fry in oil until köfte are crispy on the outside. Serve with a tomato salad and garlic yogurt dressing. Chapter 19. Checkmate. Nate and the three technical officers stood in the darkened hallway in front of Shlikov's apartment. The old concierge finally had left her post for the evening, and the CIA men had silently walked up four flights of stairs, each stepping in the slipstream of the other's tension. Last in line, Nate saw that even though the staircase was well-washed marble, the good old boys by habit walked on the outside of the treads to avoid squeaks. Each step likewise was taken supinating on the outside of their cowboy boot soles, eliminating the sound of footfalls on the stairwell. This had all been Nate's plan, the ghost transmissions, the signals, the surveillance. For the final act, he had blithely suggested an entry to Shlikov's Beilu apartment. But Nate had never before gone in with a veteran surreptitious entry team. He was nervous as the whole show revolved around this break-in. Thank Christ these old boys were unflappable. The lead tech, a 55-year-old Peckerwood from Alabama named Gaylord, knelt in front of Shlikov's door. He had a pot belly and knuckly hands. His white hair was wavy. His teammates had told Nate that he could pick any lock. Gaylord looked at the lock, turned to the others and whispered, "We got a Russian in an apartment in Turkey, and the door's got a Yale lock." Nate was unsure whether the discovery of a Yale lock in Turkey was in effect good or bad, but concluded it must be good. With bird-like fingers on those beefsteak hands, Gaylord inserted a brass bump key into the keyway, feeling the pins through the tips of his fingers. He seated the key firmly, applied slight pressure on the cylinder, and sharply wrapped the bow of the key with the rubber handle of a screwdriver. The pins jumped with the shock transmitted through the bump key, the cylinder rotated, and they were in. No emotion out of any of them. They just straightened and quietly entered the darkened apartment. Shlikov's apartment smelled neutral, like an intensive care unit, hot and sanitized. It was neither messy nor neat. He didn't have many possessions. The great repositories of a man's secrets, the bedside table drawers, were empty. No books, no porn, no pics. Empty. The second window into a man's life, the fridge. No beer, no veg, no spice, no ice. The box was cold and sour. Most of all, Nate could not identify in the apartment where Shlikov's personal spot was. No armchair with reading lamp, no ass-worn couch in front of the television, no canvas chair on the grimy little balcony. Did this guy hang by his heels from the closet rod until dusk? Nate checked his watch. They had an hour-long window. Shlikov was propping up a wall at a dip party, watching fellow Russians, not working the crowd. He was too important to bother with dip targets. He had the covert action to propel him to his colonelcy. Three base officers in a loose circle around the Russian, eating, drinking, laughing, and handing off the eye, would punch Nate's number when the major started moving. The techs were moving separately in the apartment in a smooth, practiced choreography dividing the rooms into cylindrical search sectors, high, low, middle, looking for the telltale wires of bugs or cameras, though it was unlikely that arrogant Major Shlikov would take such security precautions. No touching, no talking, their eyes moved in the dim light. Nate stood in the middle of the living room and waited. The Mississippi boy named Lee, baby of the group at age 52, moved to Shlikov's bedroom and in 30 seconds had found a well-worn, hard-sided suitcase under the bed. He weighed it in his hand and nodded. He dipped into the small bag slung over his shoulder, no rummaging around, no sound, and came out with a pair of pincer pliers that looked as though they had first been used in 1415 at Agincourt. Nate kneeled beside him as Lee gently pulled off the aluminum flashing around the upper lid and using a long, thin spatula carefully pried apart the two sandwich layers of molded plastic. He snapped his fingers softly to attract Nate's attention. From his own bag, Nate took out the glassine envelope and carefully slid two secret writing carbons, specialized, essential, and incriminating, between the layers of the lid. Lee then squeezed the layers together, applied a dot of adhesive, and fitted the flashing back around the edge of the lid. He crimped the aluminum tight and pointed with his finger. Nate saw that Lee's crimping tool had purposely left tiny teeth marks in the aluminum. Lee slid the suitcase back under the bed. Nate again checked his watch through sweat-stung eyes and moved back to the living room. Gaylord and the third tech, a jolly Falstaff from upstate New York named Ginsburg, meanwhile had spread a tack cloth on the floor and were feeling with artisan's hands the grain of a large wooden chessboard standing on its edge. Where had they found it? All Russians love chess, thought Nate. Was this Shlikov's defining hobby? It was his bad luck, whatever it was. Ginsburg took an instrument of the Inquisition out of his bag, black handle, guide rails, battery pack. The tool itself made only a faint crunching termite sound as he plunged a 3-inch-deep mortise into the wood along the end. Gaylord sucked up the sawdust with a silent handheld vacuum as it came off the bit and cleaned out the hole. They both looked at Nate, who stepped forward and inserted a tiny 2-inch square notepad with gummed edges, a one-time pad called an OTP, into the cavity. This was a block of tiny pages of printed numbers and random sequences used to provide an ever-changing and therefore unbreakable key to encrypt messages. One-time pads had been used forever in the Great War, inside the Bastille dungeons, and on the Roman roads of Judea. Gaylord, meanwhile, had taken the collected sawdust and mixed it in a shallow beaker with an odorless chemical from a squeeze bottle to create a thick batter. Fitting a plastic plug into the cavity to protect the OTP, he smeared the paste over the mortise hole and troweled it even along the edge of the board, like a pastry chef smoothing frosting on a cake. He blew on the spot, tested it with the tips of ridiculously sensitive fingers, and in a few minutes lightly sanded it smooth. Nate shined the penlight as Gaylord held a color wheel to the chessboard, then painted the area. It disappeared into the exact shade of the wood. "You sure they'll find this?" whispered Nate. Ginsburg looked him up and down. "If they're looking for it, guaranteed. The cavity'll light up on a fluoroscope like a polyp on your colonoscopy." Nate looked at Ginsburg and nodded thoughtfully. Given his age, the grizzled tech perhaps was speaking from recent experience. Whatever Ginsburg intended to say, there was a certain anatomical irony. When the chessboard and suitcase were discovered by Russian counterintelligence officers, Shlikov figuratively would be bent over and would experience the long arm of Kremlin justice. As it turned out, they did, and he was. After a month of burst communications heating up Russian SIGINT antennas in Turkey, followed by the shootouts, the Kremlin had enough. Colonel Igorova traveled unannounced to Istanbul to observe the situation in the consulate, accompanied by two FSB heavies collegially lent by FSB Chief Bortnikov, who expected Igorova would discredit Shlikov and prove to the president that the Security Council members who opposed the rash Obvil operation had been correct. Intermittent rain squalls blown in from the Sea of Marmara were slashing across the runway when Dominica's Aeroflot flight from Moscow arrived in Istanbul's Ataturk Airport. As the plane taxied to the gate, the rain pattering against the smudged windows, she could feel the thready pulse under her jaw. She was about to initiate a conspirazia against a dangerous adversary and, she presumed, his Spetsnaz bull mastiff, though Blokin had not been seen in the city at all. She was in a foreign country now, and the Turks were shrewd and aggressive. This was hostile territory, and she was here to conduct a mock counterintelligence investigation, the result of which had to be the arrest of Valery Shlikov for treason. She had a delicate role to play. A too facile conclusion to her investigation might raise suspicions. She would have to discover the evidence against this ambitious officer plausibly and convincingly. The role-playing starts now, she thought, as the plane jerked to a stop. As she entered the modern arrivals hall with its soaring vaulted ceiling, the burnt nut aroma of Turkish coffee in the air enveloped her and reminded her she was now in the mysterious Orient, among the small dark men who watched all Yabanji, foreigners, with distrust and uncertainty. She walked past a small takeout cantina, a steam table laden with appetizers, roasted peppers and garlic, flat kufta sprinkled with sumac, a tray of kabak gratin, golden zucchini gratin. Past customs, two nervous officers from the Russian consulate rushed up to greet her, bobbing their heads. An SVR colonel was an important visitor. Chin up, Dominika walked with them to the waiting car, saying nothing. Istanbul was this morning a mass of blocked roads, snarled traffic, and emergency vehicles. The police action of last night had resulted in the capture of lethal munitions of Russian manufacture. Endless television news reported the killing of scores of PKK separatists in as many firefights. The Grand National Assembly met in emergency session. The TNP put the captured landmines and rocket tubes on display. In the Russian consulate, an apoplectic Valery Shlikov cursed. He suspected perfidy and betrayal from some quarter. As Shlikov raved, the junior officers in the residentura cowered, clueless. This ambitious GRU major had lorded it over everyone and had not briefed them on the covert action to ensure compartmentation and security, but really so he could hog the credit. Gorelikov regrets I have to make this trip, thought Dominika, but I do not. Apart from their compromising Shlikov, the Istanbul trip would, of course, be an opportunity to meet her CIA handlers, their first contact since New York. She had been past the address of an Istanbul yala, an elegant three-story wooden Turkish Baroque mansion in Anadolu Kavayi, a resort town on the Asian side of the Bosphorus, designated CIA safe house Amaranth. The mansion had been rented by a real estate firm in Beverly Hills ostensibly for peripatetic senior Hollywood studio executive Blanche Goldberg, who used the house twice a year to meet mesmeric French film star Yves Berlion, with whom she'd had an on-again, off-again love affair for 3 years and counting. You never knew with a French lover. Blanche was only vaguely witting that the house was paid for by CIA. She didn't ask the reason, but made her contribution to the love nest cover for status by keeping a bedroom armoire full of expensive Beverly Hills lingerie and toiletries, including a bottle of Swiss Navy lube in the elegant master bathroom medicine cabinet. In Moscow, Dominika had been passed descriptions of the CIA moves to discredit Shlikov via thumb drives placed at a timed drop site in the bushy verge against the ornamental wall of the Zhinovoshalnoi Troitsi Temple on Kosyzhina Ulitsa, on the southern border of the Vorobyovi Gori, Sparrow Hills Park, on the Luzhniki bend of the Moskva River. Benford himself had included the key information regarding what Dominika should look for in Shlikov's apartment. Chemically treated brochures, suitcase lining with crimped flashing, chessboard. The result was that Dominika was aware of every nuance of the CIA sting and could direct her investigation unerringly to the evidence, to the astonished admiration of her FSB wingmen. She noted that suspicious Western foreigners were sitting across from Shlikov at lunch. Were they signaling him? The FSB boys followed them, and they turned out to be U.S. consulate employees, presumed CIA. She spotted a thumbtack signal in a tree near Shlikov's apartment that was pushed in too low to affix a poster. A horizontal chalk mark that was noted on a wall outside Shlikov's apartment building on one day had a fresh vertical cross-stroke 2 days later, and the electronic burst messages continued. Things were looking decidedly worse for Major Shlikov. At no time did Shlikov mentally connect the massive operational flap culminating in running police shootouts at 20 locations in the city with any singular personal failure in tradecraft, comsec, or planning. He was rarely burdened by introspection. Now this ridiculous Igorova had arrived to conduct a preposterous investigation on some nonsense about transmissions, and the timing ensured she would be here to witness his humiliation. He had been ordered to remain in Istanbul until the post-mortem of Obval was complete. The interview with a scowling Shlikov seated at the table in the residentura's secure room developed nicely. Valerie reacted angrily when asked about the mysterious transmissions, claimed not to know any Americans in town, and dismissed as ridiculous the existence of clandestine signals near his apartment. The FSB officers present looked at one another skeptically. Things got more interesting when Shlikov flatly refused to let the FSB donkeys search his apartment. The yellow halo around his head, bleached by rage and pulsing with fright, told Dominika a lot. His fear of career disintegration was eclipsed by his Bolshoi Somomenny, his self-importance and his outrage at being challenged and questioned, especially by a woman. He'll hang himself with that ego, Dominika thought. This would be easier than she expected. This is an uncomfortable situation for us all, said Dominika equably. I personally regret the need to interview a fellow colleague from the GRU.
Then fly back to Moscow and leave me to my work, said Shlikov. I have critical operational tasks which you should realize take precedence.
He glared at Dominika with the disdain of privileged Soviet golden youth. Yes, well, the police shootouts in this city with your terrorist protégés seem to suggest that your critical operational tasks have not been totally successful. In fact, they were unrelievedly disastrous, said Dominika. They almost certainly may yet prove to be damaging to the Russian Federation and embarrassing to the President. In the silence that followed, every Russian in that interview room knew that damaging the country was by far the lesser delinquency.
I'll attend to the operations, said Shlikov, seething. He decided to add a towering insult. Why don't you concentrate on what you do best, filming yourself seducing men?
I suggest you take a less defiant line, said Dominika. It is unfortunate. The FSB men heard something in her voice that made them shift in their seats. Shlikov seemed not to register the danger.
There are anomalies that correspond to your movements, said Dominika. I trust they will amount to nothing, but I am here to confirm that there are no counterintelligence issues.
Do you think I am working for the Americans? Shlikov shouted. You're ridiculous. Porshio nahui, fuck off.
He stood and loomed over Dominika.
I advise you to sit down and cooperate, said Dominika, looking up at him.
Shlikov bent over her and stuck his face in hers. The FSB men sat on the edge of their chairs.
Your reputation precedes you, said Shlikov, the wonder girl with the big siski, the well-titted-out prostitute trained to suck off.
Dominika's hand shot out and grabbed Shlikov's jutting bottom lip between forefinger and thumb and pulled down hard. The major grunted with the pain and went to his knees. Dominika twisted his lip and slammed his head against the edge of the table. Shlikov sat on the floor and held his head. His lip had already swelled and gone purple, and his right eye was closed.
"Consider yourself confined to the residentura," said Dominika, standing. "You can sleep on the duty officer cot. A security officer will be with you at all times."
She turned to the FSB men.
"Get the keys to Comrade Shlikov's residence, both front door and apartment," she said. "I want to go there now."
At the apartment, the FSB bloodhounds did Dominika's work for her. She didn't have to prompt them at all. In fact, she praised their diligence. They gathered all the papers in Shlikov's desk drawer and found the suitcase under the bed and showed Colonel Igorova the telltale marks on the lid, suggesting some tampering. They hefted the big wooden chessboard they found on the upper shelf in the front closet, shook their heads, and were going to leave it. Dominika shrugged, pulled out more drawers, and rummaged around the closet.
Strange, she said. Have you found chess pieces, a chess set?
The FSB men looked around, shook their heads, and suggested they take the chessboard back to the consulate and examine it under the fluoroscope, used to screen incoming mail and packages. Dominica looked doubtful.
Very well, she said. It's better to check, to be thorough.
Bestrudne vitashish ibribku izruda,
said one of the FSB men loftily. Without effort, you won't pull a fish out of the pond.
I suppose you're right, said Dominica. Let's see what we find.
Josip Blokin had not appeared anywhere in Istanbul during the disastrous failure of Obvol. There had been a firefight between TNP shock troops and PKK cell members barricaded in a private house in the historic Rumelihisari neighborhood on the Bosphorus that had been fierce and prolonged, suggesting that the normally unsophisticated PKK terrorists had received tactical advice from a professional. A police picket line in the woods around the house detained a stocky man making his way through the trees as the shooting began tapering off, and he was taken into custody in the police precinct house in Arnavutköy on the basis that he had no identification. When the burly man in East Block English claimed he was a Russian diplomat and demanded to see a consulate official, the police lieutenant called the coordinating captain. It was Hanefi, who in turn called his American friend Nathaniel Nash and offered him the opportunity to speak to the Russian who the Turks strongly suspected was a professional soldier. Hanefi said he could give Nash an hour alone with the Russian before Russian dips arrived to spring him. Nate accepted and quickly called Benford to say this had to be Blokin, who Dominica was sure had killed the two women and two cops in New York, her North Korean asset and her sparrow in Vienna. Go hard on this ape, said Benford. Pitch him. Your cover's blown to these Bolsheviks anyway. And tell him we know what he did. Say we got him on Hilton Hotel security cameras to protect Diva. Tell the son of a bitch the next time he shows a hair of his ass outside Russia, we'll extradite him to New York to stand trial for the dissident's murder, said Benford. Burn him so badly he'll be useless to them from now on. It's highly unlikely, but what if he's ready to play ball? How high are you willing to go to get him in harness, said Nate. 3 years substantively working in place inside, he gets $1 million. He wants out now, he'll get $250,000 after a meaningful debriefing in the United States. Money contingent on production, the usual. See if that shakes his tree. Get something solid from him as a sign of good faith before you agree to anything, said Benford. Okay, I'll talk to him tonight and let you know, said Nate. I'm prepping for the meet tomorrow with Domi. I'll get over there early and get things set up for Marty. When's he get in? He's not coming, said Benford thinly. I had to send him to Sudan. A wheel came off in Khartoum Station. Marty's not coming, said Nate, his stomach flipping. I trust you heard me, unless your ears were affected by the blood rushing to your lower extremities, said Benford. Gable is Diva's primary handler, said Nate. And you are her backup officer, said Benford. You know how this works, Nash. You debrief her, review commo and sights, make sure she's operating safely. Did you receive the requirements, Cable? It came in this morning, said Nate. Then go and do your job, said Benford, and endeavor not to ruin the asset with your beastly manner, or do I have to come out there myself? No, I'll handle it, said Nate. You'll get a wrap-up, Cable, when we're done. Good hunting, said Benford, hanging up. Blokin was in a small gray interrogation room at the police station that was bare except for two metal chairs. Hanefi met Nate outside the door and they took turns looking at him through the peephole.
Bir eşik oglu, muttered Hanefi. A son of a donkey. Nate Bey, he looks dangerous. Dikkatli old, be careful. Do you want a man in the room?
Nate shook his head.
Tabanca? A pistol?
No. I want to squeeze him and don't want him to lose face. But if you hear me screaming, come in and shoot him, said Nate.
I am thinking he is in Istanbul for organizing the cells, said Hanefi. With no diplomatic papers, we put him in Silivri prison for 20 years, but because Ankara fears trouble with Moscow, he is free after you finish with him. Ili Shanslar, Nate Bey. Good luck.
Nate pulled open the door and stepped into the room, which was dimly lighted by a single bare bulb.
Plokin stood in a corner, leaning against the wall, his tree trunk arms crossed over his chest. There was a bruise under his right eye, probably a corrective love tap from a TNP jailer who didn't like Russians. Nate sat in one of the chairs and slid the other chair a foot toward Plokin, an invitation to sit, but the sergeant remained standing. Nate knew he was unlikely to find this guy's buttons, but there was nothing to lose. A brief bio on Plokin had been spun up, but there wasn't much. "Sergeant Yosip Plokin," said Nate in fluent Russian. "Congratulations on the charada, the charade of last night. I thought Spetsnaz was better than that." Plokin stared at him. "It's hard to imagine you going along with such a half-baked plan, but that's GRU for you. Amateurs," said Nate. Plokin didn't move. "Push another button." "Of course you'll be blamed for the unsatisfactory operation," said Nate. "No one in the Kremlin or the Security Council or the General Staff will support you. Major Shlikov will cast you aside like the pack animal he thinks you are. They may even cashier you out of Spetsnaz. What group are you in, Alpha or Vimpel?" Plokin uncrossed his arms, pushed off from the wall, and stood behind the metal chair looking down at Nate. He slowly sat down, back straight, hands on his thighs. Nate braced for a lunge. "You are CIA?" Plokin asked. His voice was like gravel poured out of a bucket. "If they kick you out of Spetsnaz, what will you do in Moscow?" said Nate, ignoring the question. "Become a driver on a city tram, collect tickets at Dynamo Stadium? Do you have a family to feed, parents?" "Come on, big boy, tell me something, anything." "You come from Washington?" asked Plokin, tilting his head as if Nate had blown a dog whistle. "Washington is close to New York City," said Nate. "Ever been there? Ever been to the Hilton on 6th Avenue?" Blokin's face was impassive, but his pupils dilated.
"What do you want?"
said Plokin, sitting back in his chair. "An opening? Work it." "We both serve our countries loyally, sometimes endure hardships, but in your system there are no rewards except the pride you take in having served. But that will be gone when you return to the Rodina. They will take that away from you in the space of a deep breath." Plokin said nothing. "We are not enemies," Nate said with a straight face. "We are both soldiers in different uniforms, perhaps, but we both understand loyalty. In America, we value loyalty and friendship and repay it. Our soldiers retire with benefits and live in comfort."
"What do you want?" Plokin repeated.
"I have a proposal, a way for you to reap the benefits you have earned. Something for you, apart from Russia and Spetsnaz and Shlikov." Plokin waited. "Talk to us about what is happening in Russia, in the army, in Spetsnaz," said Nate. "Do it for yourself. You deserve the rewards."
"I will dishonor my uniform, my oath," said Plokin, shaking his head.
"They dishonor you already," said Nate.
"You dishonor me. Your proposal is an insult."
He didn't ask how much, he just slammed the door. "I want you to know that authorities in New York have fingerprints and DNA found in Daria Rapina's hotel room," said Nate. "They will be compared against samples just taken from you by the Turks. There is no doubt there soon will be an Interpol warrant out for your arrest, and Washington will request your extradition to stand trial." Plokin smiled thinly. He knew Moscow would never agree to that. "What this means is that you will be obliged to remain in Russia indefinitely, to avoid immediate arrest by a foreign government," Nate continued. "Your days as a clandestine military operator are over. This neudacha, this fiasco in Istanbul will be your last operation, an unfortunate professional legacy for which you will be remembered." A bit dramatic, that. Nate knew Shlikov was already well and properly framed, and Plokin at most would be criticized and demoted for his part. The added indignity of being pitched by the Americans after being arrested would be intense. Plokin got up from his chair, returned to the corner, and leaned against the wall.
"I hope our paths cross again," said Plokin, in English.
As he walked out of the police station, Nate erased Plokin from his mind. He was meeting Dominika tomorrow. Nate took a deep breath. "Goddamn hell shit bitch," as Hanefi would say. This was going to be tricky. He could attend to the debriefing professionally, no problem. Intel first, followed by ops intel and CI. establish a sched for future meetings, then review security, sights, and signals. Doing all this in 5 hours, the last Bosphorus ferry back to town was at 1800 hours, was going to mean that they would sit down and work straight through. It would mean Nate must keep his mind on business, even if Dominica put her slim, cool hand on his arm, or if her just-washed hair brushed his cheek, or if she laughed and stuck out her tongue at him. He would ignore that trademark sideways glance that meant she wanted him, invariably accompanied by the barely perceptible lifting of the hem of her skirt, a come-on from her sparrow past. He could imagine Gable's comment. Nash'll be playing 20 toes with her in 5 minutes, and Forsythe would shake his head ruefully, disappointed. Maybe he'd surprise everyone and instead convince her about coming out with him, defecting, quitting, leaving the danger and the dread and the risk, and starting a new life together. What if she says, yes, let's go, right now, I'm ready, Nate thought. Besides meaning the end of his CIA career and the work that defined him, it would also mean the loss of the agency's best Russian source with irreplaceable access to Putin's Kremlin, and he'd be the cause. Dark ancillary thoughts emerged. Could either of them live without the sustaining excitement of this work, the knife-edge bustle of the street, the adrenaline high of stealing secrets from an implacable foe? What would their retired life be like? Would they look at the snowy Rockies from the porch of a log cabin? Or eat breakfast on a white balcony overlooking Biscayne Bay? Or throw another log on the fire in a cozy New England farmhouse? A conjugal dream or a constricting nightmare? Could either of them survive retirement? Gable always said that spooks dried up and died when they left the game. Most Russian defectors went around the bend away from the Rodina. They missed the motherland, the black earth, and the pine forests. Could he do that to her? To himself? Jesus, maybe he had scared himself straight. Maybe she'd see the light, too. Maybe they would move to the next chaste and professional level of super asset and sagacious handler, coolly taking care of business against Vladimir Putin and his predatory kleptocracy. Maybe. And anyway, what was that fucking Gable doing in Khartoum, now of all times? Turkish zucchini gratin. Halve small zucchinis lengthwise, then scoop out pockets and fill with cubed feta cheese, chopped dill, and parsley. Cover zucchinis with bechamel and bake in medium oven until zucchinis are soft and topping is golden brown. Chapter 20, The Great Confluence. It was midnight. From the plane window coming in, Gable saw the bulbous, luminous, blue-glass Carinthia Hotel on the river, a fat teardrop rising above the low brown wattle of Khartoum, otherwise punctuated only by a forest of lighted minarets. His plane banked farther and he could make out the Almogran, the great confluence where the chocolate-brown Blue Nile joined the milky blue White Nile. Outside the terminal, the brakes of the canary-yellow taxi squealed like a pissed-off baboon. Probably the red Sudanese dust on the pads, thought Gable. The shit gets everywhere. The drive from the airport to the U.S. Embassy, it was south of town on the banks of the Blue Nile, took an hour, down riotous four-lane Madani Street cloaked in blue exhaust, with traffic coming in and out from all directions, even at this hour. It was a familiar zoo, Khartoum. Gable was back on his old stomping grounds, the benighted Third World, where you debriefed recruited generals with sweat-shiny faces and gritty Land Rovers parked in stinking alleys, and a cotton-candy sandstorm's 300 feet high would rattle the house, red sand hissing under the door despite the wet towels jammed against the threshold, and where you got used to the sudden tire thump while driving at night, which was either something four-legged and furry, or a local sleeping off a Tishwala beer bender in the middle of the road. You didn't stop to find out, not at night. The Third World. Russian diplomats posted to Paris didn't need CIA guys to buy them baguettes. But meet a lonely Russian and barren alien Khartoum, his family back in Moscow, and give him some Chevalier soup, sorrel soup, like his mama used to fix, and put on a DVD and open a bottle of bourbon, and you could talk to him endlessly about American salaries or muscle cars or Las Vegas pussy, or maybe just about the freedom to choose in some dust-stormy night with the shutters rattling. He'd say yes, and you'd have an SVR recruitment in the bag. Some of Gable's best scalps came from the sandbox. COS Khartoum Gordon Gondorf was sitting at his desk in the station on the top floor of the embassy, a two-wing, three-story blockhouse on a five-acre compound with grenade-proof slit windows and a curved steel porte-cochere. COS Khartoum was short, pig-eyed, and preternaturally obtuse. Gable often said Gondorf couldn't pour water out of a boot if the instructions were printed on the sole. Known as Little Feet by the beleaguered officers in his stations, Gondorf seemed to reappear every 2 years like a fever blister. He had been the chief in Moscow, where he tried to fuck Nash's career, then went on to ruin Latin America division and subsequently became COS Paris, where he refused to mobilize resources to look for an escaped CIA traitor loose in the city. This consistent performance had earned him everlasting scorn from Benford, who arranged for Gondorf to be given his current command. This uncomfortable third-tier station where you had to check to see if a boom slang was coiled under the rim, resting in the cool of the toilet porcelain before you sat down. Gondorf's office was dominated by a huge wooden desk reflecting his belief that the larger it was, the more gravitas it conferred on the person sitting behind it. This theory was vitiated somewhat by the fact that the glass top came up only chest-high on the chief, giving the enduring impression of a red-faced little boy sitting at his father's desk on family day. A dusty A4 rifle was propped in a corner as if the chief personally engaged terrorist cells in Khartoum every day before lunch. Of course, there was the usual vanity wall, covered with photographs of Gondorf being greeted by members of Congress, foreign dignitaries, and diplomats in tuxedos. A single-framed photograph of Gondorf incongruously dressed as a Bedouin, with a jambia, the curved ceremonial dagger of the Arab world, stuck in his belt, epitomized his catchpenny career. A camel in the background of the photo glared at him as if the half-pint desert nomad owed him money. Gable was only faintly aware of Gondorf's current dilemma. Benford had not related the details. The story came out in halting sentences punctuated with, through no fault of mine, or no one could have anticipated, or events beyond anyone's control. Months ago, Washington had resolved to covertly deliver shoulder-fired surface-to-air missiles to rebels in Darfur, southern Sudan, to offset massive military aid from Russia and China flowing to the genocidal host government in Khartoum. It was vital that the U.S. aid be kept secret to avoid bilateral friction. At the 11th hour, a dithering national security advisor changed her mind, resulting in canceled plans to deliver the missiles. A pallet load, 12 5-foot dark green aluminum cases with metal handles of the missiles, were stranded in a secure storeroom in the basement of the embassy. The cases were smuggled in as construction materials, but getting them out was a different matter. They could not be driven to the airport and flown out on the weekly support flight. If Sudanese customs officials inspected the pallet, the diplomatic flap would be unsustainable. During a heated embassy principals meeting, the ambassador declared himself unwilling to keep a dozen FIM-92 Stinger missiles with high-explosive annular blast fragmentation warheads in his chancery indefinitely. The military attaché called Malat, Marine Colonel Claude Bianchi, respectfully submitted that he had no way to extract the cases until the carrier USS Nimitz transited the Red Sea in a week, at which time a Seahawk helicopter could be flown in to extract the missiles. Extended-range tanks could be fitted on the bird to make the 450-mile flight. COS Gondorf, eager to curry favor with his chief of mission and outshine the Malat, coyly declared that he had assets capable of disposing of the munitions right now. In this, he overplayed his hand. Displaying monumental bad judgment, Gondorf had directed three low-level Sudanese support assets to load the cases onto a stake truck, exit out the back gate of the embassy, drive 100 yards east across the fallow sunflower field, and dump them into the river. Gable sat up. "In the fucking Nile?" he said. "These cases are 50 pounds each," said Gondorf miserably. "They sank right away." "I don't care if there was a friggin' glacier over there," said Gable. "You dumped them 100 yards from the embassy?" "We did it at night so no one could see," said Gondorf. "I don't know what's wrong with you, Gondorf, but I bet it's hard to pronounce," said Gable.
There's another problem, said Gondorf. He walked to the window, raised the blinds, handed Gable a pair of binoculars, and pointed toward the river. Gable focused on the riverbank, fringed by a thin line of vegetation.
Holy shit, said Gable. The black mud bank was littered by the missile cases, some on their sides, some sticking straight up, like uprooted coffins.